I think going there, to me, it just brings me back to sort of the basics of peds ortho and just managing and taking good care of patients.
From Spa Dameron Tenney, it's the Prosperous Doc Podcast. Real stories, real inspiration, real growth. A show for doctors who are ready to improve their overall wellness in every aspect of life. Now here's your host, Shane Tenney.
Welcome back to the Prosperous Doc Podcast. My name is Shane Tenney. Glad to have you with us today. In fact, odds are high, if you're listening to this show, that you are one of the elite group of healthcare providers in this country taking care of our population. And we are so blessed in America to not only have such highly trained healthcare providers, whether it's teeth or gums or blood or bone or lungs, but not only do we have healthcare providers that are trained at such a high level, we have access to them. And it's something that too often we take for granted, especially when not every country in our world has access to the level of healthcare that we do. My guest today has been treating and caring for some of our youngest patients and recently had the opportunity to return to something that has meant so much to him, which is medical missions work. A couple months ago in the fall of 2023, he was able to travel on medical missions again for the first time since the pandemic kind of subsided. And today I'm excited to have him with us to tell his story about what medical missions has meant to him as a pediatric orthopedic surgeon, and maybe even inspire you to consider doing something like this as well. I'm excited to welcome Dr. Brian Scannell to the Prosperous Doc Podcast today. Brian, great to have you with me.
Thanks, Shane. I appreciate you having me today.
Yeah, I know we had fun talking for a couple minutes before I pushed the record button today just about the work that you do and the work that you've been able to do overseas, and excited to hear that today. I often will just ask my guests to back up a little bit and give us the quick journey into medicine. And in particular, I'm curious for you, where in your training cycle did you decide orthopedics and then tiny people?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And that's how I would describe my practice in peds ortho, is ortho and tiny people. I mean, my parents would probably say that I wanted to be a doctor for a long time, even when I was younger, but I don't really feel like I made that kind of final commitment until towards the end of college, you know, and I knew I wanted to do something at that point within medicine. I actually really thought I was going to be a pediatrician, probably a subspecialist within pediatrics. I knew I wanted to do something kind of more procedural at that time, and I loved working with kids. Kids are resilient for the most part, and much more so than we are as adults. They tend to do really well too. You know, and certainly in my world in ortho, the majority of the kids do really, really well. I was kind of set for a while. And I mean, I had orthopedics in the back of my mind and I was trying to kind of decide on what I wanted to do. And for many of us, what influences what we go into, it's based on mentors, mentorship, and some of the relationships that we develop and build over time. And I had gotten close with actually one of the pediatric faculty at UNC Chapel Hill. She was a general pediatrician and kind of saw her as one of my mentors. And one day, I think probably in third year, I walked in and talked to her and I said, well, I don't know what I want to do. I really love orthopedics. I loved surgery. My first surgery exposure was GYN oncology and I loved it. And that's when I kind of fell a little bit more in love with the surgical side of medicine. And so I talked to her about that and I loved orthopedics and I loved pediatrics. And we kind of talked through all the reasons and she looked at me and she was a pediatrician and she said, you need to be an orthopedic surgeon. Like, I think in talking with you, that's what it sounds like you want to do with your life and with your career. And my wife's a pediatrician and no offense to pediatricians, it's just, it wouldn't have fit with me and my personality. And so she helped me kind of see a little bit of maybe what I wasn't seeing at the time and helped me make that decision. And then, you know, again, mentors are so huge. I had a good friend of mine growing up here in Charlotte. His father was an orthopedic trauma surgeon, and I had the ability to kind of work with him a little bit when I was in undergrad doing some research and working with him again when I came through as a medical student. And that was pretty influential on me in kind of deciding that orthopedics was the direction. Peds ortho was an awesome combination for me of everything I liked about orthopedics. Pediatric orthopedics, we certainly, a lot of us have like a subspecialty niche within our practice. but I get to do a little bit of everything.
Yeah. So what kind of cases do you do? What's your niche?
All of us here in Charlotte. So there's five pediatric orthopedic surgeons in Charlotte. We all manage and take care of trauma patients. So fracture care. Within my practice, I'd say the one thing I don't do is sort of sports medicine and ACLs, meniscus, that sort of thing, because we kind of have enough people here in Charlotte that do. My niche, I do a lot of scoliosis and spine deformity cases. So that's kind of my biggest interest. And then I do a lot of other congenital problems. So club feet, hip dysplasia in infants and children. And then I still take care of a pretty high population of, you know, syndromic kids, spina bifida, cerebral palsy as well. And so I love my practice just because I get to sort of operate all over the body still. You know, as people select different specialties within orthopedics, sometimes you're selecting something and you lose out on something else that you might like. And I think that's kind of the beauty. I get to do some foot and ankle surgery. I get to operate on hips. I get to do spine surgery. And I'm still doing trauma care, and that allows me to do some deformity because of trauma or other reasons too. So I get to do a little bit of everything within peds ortho, which is really what I enjoy the most.
It's fascinating. And through that, as I was saying in the intro, you've now been able to go on your second medical missions trip with an organization called Project Perfect World. And so I'm curious, I guess, connect the dots here for us. When did you kind of feel a stirring or an interest in doing a medical missions trip, and how'd you connect with Project Perfect World?
There was probably always a little bit of an interest there. I mean, there's a lot of our time that we give as physicians that I would probably consider unpaid time to patients and other people in the community. I think doing something like this, I actually got drawn into it through some longer term friendships that I have. The group that I went with back in 2018, they were all fellows together out at Rady Children's Hospital the year before I was a fellow there. And so one of those was actually a guy I did residency training with. And so I kind of just became really good friends with them. It was something that they did on an annual basis for a number of years. And it just so happened one of the guys, his sister was getting married, and they asked me to kind of step in and go back in 2018. And so now we kind of have a group of about six of us that sort of alternate in. So maybe people aren't having to do it every year, because it is. It's a pretty big time commitment, time away from family, time away from work. So now we kind of have a little bit larger crew of physicians that go down there. It's a great group.
And go down where? Things that we need to define here.
Yeah. So Project Perfect World is primarily now in Ecuador. There's two trips a year that occur, and one in the fall and then one in the springtime. And we kind of have a fall team and a spring team, so they stay a little bit consistent. We bring about 25 to 30 people down. And so it's including our surgeons. We bring orthotists and prosthetic people. We bring our own anesthesia team, our own nursing team. So it's a pretty robust team that travels down there together. It has been in a city called Guayaquil. Guayaquil is a port city in Ecuador, one of the larger cities behind the capital, which is Quito. If you're flying, for those that do travel, you got to fly to Guayaquil to get to the Galapagos Islands. So it's not too far, but it is a major port city and probably one of their main, you know, economic cities down in Ecuador.
And how did Project Perfect World get connected to Ecuador in particular?
Yeah. So the bigger details I'm not as sure about are the nitty gritty details, but Bob Simpson was a guy that started Project Perfect World, he and his family. And my understanding, they had a son that passed away after being hit by a drunk driver. And they were looking for something to kind of honor their son's memory. And so I'm not sure how they ended up in Ecuador, but they ended up traveling there and helping to kind of refurbish a medical clinic there. And so that's how it started, I think, in the late 80s. And then over the course of kind of the 90s into the 2000s, and then really when our group started going, which was about 2010, was when it kind of became a little bit more focused on orthopedic care, because there was such a need in the country for that. And ever since, it's all of our trips are all kind of pediatric orthopedic related.
Talk a little bit about then, you're going with essentially an entire medical team to populate, I guess, one or two of the operating rooms at the hospital in Guayaquil. Yep. And so what's the setup for that? How do they help organize the logistics? What, for those who haven't done surgery in Ecuador, what are the conditions like?
They're actually pretty good. You know, when I first went down in 18, I was probably a little surprised at you know, the quality. I mean, there's plenty of really nice places that I've operated in the U.S. and plenty that needed a little bit of that refurbishing as well. You know, I'd say overall conditions were pretty good. I think the biggest thing for us going in there on an annual basis is really working with the local surgeons. So we don't want it to be that we're bringing this massive team in just to displace what they're doing at the Children's Hospital. I think that's important on a lot of levels, but in relationship building with a lot of the local surgeons that are there, we don't want them to feel like they're just getting pushed out because the team from America is coming to kind of help out for a few weeks a year. And so I think, you know, a lot of that takes some communication ahead of time. When we go down there, the first day is an all-day clinic. And so they actually have patients like lined up. That part is certainly a little bit different than what we have in the States, where you come and see me and you have an 8 o'clock or an 8:10 appointment. And there we had either a morning or an afternoon. So we had about 30 people that just showed up early in the morning. And then we had about another 30 to 40 people in the afternoon. And so the four surgeons, we would kind of alternate rooms and just kind of see everybody so that we can figure out what can we do during the week and what work and patients can we actually take care of. And part of that is, you know, we're working with some of the local surgeons. They're involved, whether it's helping from a translation standpoint, whether it's helping from getting us the x-rays that we need to look at. Some of the time they were bringing some of their own kind of private patients in for us to see as well, to see if there were things that we could do to help some of their patients as well, and not just some of the patients of this particular children's hospital where we're working. I mean, our anesthesia team brings all their, you know, own equipment outside of the ventilator, but they're bringing all the medicine down to Ecuador, which is sometimes an issue of getting things into countries, particularly when it's medication related. Over the years, from an orthopedic standpoint, we've built up sort of a stockpile and donations of implants. So plates and screws and other things like that, that we have been able to kind of keep there and store there. So we actually have a storage room that we try to keep pretty organized so that each team, when they come down, they can find what they need to find in order to take care of patients. Most days we had 2 hours pretty much every day. I think the hospital probably had around 10 ORs total. They're doing all kinds of things. I mean, they had neurosurgeons that were working, ENT surgeons. Some of the other orthopedic surgeons were working at the same time as us. I'd say of things that were a little bit harder, you know, lighting wasn't that great in the OR. You know, we use in orthopedics, we use a lot of x-ray in the OR. And so we had to really be cognizant of when did we need x-ray. There were things that we were probably doing down there that we utilized less x-ray than what we do in the States, just because we didn't have somebody or have the x-ray machine there to be able to kind of take things during surgery. But that's where I think it's worked out well, that we usually did two surgeons in every surgery, which is a lot of fun operating with colleagues and friends from across the country.
When you say two surgeons, are you operating with another surgeon from the States, or are you pairing with a local surgeon for kind of cross knowledge sharing or translation or something?
Both. So I would say oftentimes what we would do is there were two of us from America that would be in every surgery. And usually one would kind of take the role as the primary surgeon, and then the other would take the role of educating. And we found that that's kind of, for us, it was kind of the most efficient way for us to kind of get patients taken care of, educate some of the local surgeons that would come into cases. And also educating some of the staff too at the hospital. And then all of our staff was from various parts of the country, the nurses and things like that. But we did a lot of education for just the nurses that came down with us as well. And many of them did peds ortho at their institutions. So I think it was fun for them to kind of be working with us. So we were doing a lot of education of some of the local surgeons that were there as well, which I think anytime you're doing mission work, I think going in and making sure that local surgeons and physicians are involved, making sure that there's good communication, making sure that there is good follow-up for those patients. So it's never something that you go in and you do these big surgeries and then you're just gone. We have a couple of the guys that I work with, some of the surgeons, talk, I think, relatively regularly with some of the surgeons. They'll send them cases and things like that. And so keeping that communication line of going is so important for things to continue to work well.
Yeah, that's great. Oh, I want to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want you to elaborate a little bit on the types of cases that you see there, because I know it's different than what you deal with in the States a little bit.
You understand your personal cash flow. You know the combination of your monthly income and monthly expenses. You ever think about how much money you made last year and wonder, where did it all go? Understanding where your money goes today is essential to creating an actionable plan to achieve your financial goals for tomorrow. Take control of your finances by downloading the free personal cash flow worksheet. The Prosperous Doc podcast is underwritten by the financial planning firm of Spaugh, Dameron, Tenney, and you can download this free personal cash flow worksheet at sdtplanning.com and click on financial resources. Don't let another month of money confusion go by when you have access to free help. Again, the website is sdtplanning.com. Click on financial resources to download the free personal cash flow worksheet.
Okay, Brian, we were talking right before the break just about the, kind of the conditions at the Children's Hospital in Ecuador, where the team serves. And I know you described clinic in kind of Latin American style, which is just show up and you'll eventually get seen, as opposed to getting an exact time slot. What are the sorts of conditions or cases that you're seeing or working on there?
I'd say probably the biggest area of things that we do with Peds Ortho when we're in Ecuador is managing congenital hip dysplasia. So I take care of a lot of babies and a lot of children with hip dysplasia here in the States. Probably the biggest differences are just here in the States, we have screening algorithms, screening protocols for a lot of babies that are at higher risk for hip dysplasia. So we're oftentimes catching it a lot earlier, whereas in Ecuador, you know, it's found late. And so some kids that are born with a dislocated hip, which happens here in the States, we may find that at birth or because of pediatric screening. We may find it, you know, early on within the first 6 months of life that we can treat a lot of those kids in braces. In Ecuador, they don't really have any screening in place for any of the babies. We're managing a lot of that hip dysplasia on older kids. So hips that are still dislocated in two-year-olds, three-year-olds, and I think we did a five-year-old this past year too, which is pretty old to be putting a hip back into place, but it's important for the longevity of that hip in order to prevent a whole host of other issues for those kids long-term in their life. The hard thing too is that we even saw like some 12-month-old babies with hips that are dislocated. But as we go through the kids that actually need surgery, so after we saw patients in clinic, we had to kind of almost triage like, well, what's important? So there were some babies that we said, listen, we're going to deal with this again in 6 months. And we need to address the three-year-old, the four-year-old that have a hip that's dislocated. Whereas like gosh, in the States, if I'm seeing a kid, I mean, that kid's getting surgery and they're going to get it pretty quickly here in the States. So we had to kind of triage a little bit of what we had resource-wise, of what we had available time-wise to be able to care for some of those kids. So hip dysplasia is probably one of the bigger ones. We did a lot of foot and ankle surgery this year. So some kids with club feet, some of them had had various treatment for it in the past, whether it be surgical or casting. Biggest difference is we do in the States, many of those kids don't need any surgery. So as an infant, we'll do casting on those babies and on their feet, whereas we're dealing with 3, 4, 5 year olds that have been walking on a club foot for the 3, 4, or 5 years of their life. And so the surgical management of that is much different. We used to do that a lot in Peds Ortho, but with casting techniques, we rarely do it here in the States anymore. Do we need to do any big kind of club foot surgeries?
Well, is there a story or a patient that has stuck with you since your trip 4 months ago?
I think there's probably a few. One of the cool things, even though many of these people, even in Ecuador, are fairly impoverished and, you know, they don't have health insurance even within Ecuador. And those were a lot of the kids that were taken care of. Cool thing is most of them all have cell phones, like families have cell phones. So I actually had some parents and even a teenage boy that we took care of that followed me on Instagram, which is pretty cool. I mean, I can watch some of his stories and stuff from Ecuador now and seen a little bit of what he's doing now after he had a pretty big foot and ankle surgery for a foot deformity that he had. that piece is kind of cool, just being still miles and miles away and still having a little bit of that connect through social media. I am certainly not a big person on social media, but it's been kind of cool to have a few patients and their families that I've still stayed connected with through that.
That's really profound to be able to, especially when you're coming in just for a week or so, you know, you don't get the luxury of doing the follow-up care in 2 weeks or a month or that sort of thing, but to be able to see their recovery and that long-term impact. So I'm curious just about the impact that this is your second trip now. In some ways, I've found in life, often the second trip is the best. The first one, you're kind of, you know, stimulus overload, figuring out what's going on. The second one, you're able to relax and kind of get in the groove a little bit. It takes time. I mean, look, let's face it. You're a surgeon. You get paid to do surgery. When you're not doing surgery, you're not making money. So it costs something to your family, to your kids, to your wife, to your checkbook to go and care for people in Ecuador. Why do you do it? What's the impact?
I mean, it's one of those things that refills the bucket, you know, and there's other things that I do to kind of help refill my bucket, but medicine and healthcare is hard and burnout is real. And we all feel that at times. And it's sort of a fun, selfless thing that I found that the patients are unbelievably grateful for. And that refills my bucket. Being able to take care of patients and sort of step away from the American healthcare system too, I think is nice. And because it kind of brings you back to just what's the right thing for this patient. And that's what we try obviously to do here, but there are some limitations. There are some things that we can't do because of insurance or other things like that. And those are one of many frustrations that physicians will have at times. And I think going there, to me, it just brings me back to sort of the basics of peds ortho and just managing and taking good care of patients. The other piece is just, I've got an unbelievable group here that I think has a great group culture. And so I do a fair amount where I operate some with my colleagues and partners. And working with other individuals and not just being on your own is really, really fun. It's even more enjoyable, like being in Ecuador and operating with these three other pediatric orthopedists, learning a little bit from them, you know, even though I'm 12 years out into practice, teaching them some things too that I do that maybe is different than what we learned in training. It's just really enjoyable to kind of have that knowledge exchange. There's the patient care part that refills the bucket, but then there's the friendship. For me, it's the friendships and the camaraderie. I mean, every night when we would get back to the hotel, it was looking at what we have the next day, the four of us sitting in a hotel room, maybe with a good bourbon with us as well, enjoying the evening, talking about what we do, about medicine, about family, about all kinds of things. That's the other piece that I think for me really refills the bucket. It's a pretty exhausting, I think we were there for her travel time included was about 9 days. And so you get back and you're pretty darn tired, but came back and got back into work and fairly rejuvenated with sort of the work that we do here in the States too.
That's impactful, I guess, to your point. In some ways, relationships are the things that make work most valuable. And there you're not only building relationships with people in Ecuador and in some cases the patients, I guess, through social media, but also with your colleagues from the States that you wouldn't have the chance to even do joint surgery with. But down there, nobody's counting the RVUs. You know, hey, let's both stand here and give it our best. That's really impactful. So, well, you know, there's a level of interest, but a barrier. You know, I'm kind of curious about this, but what about the time or what's it going to be like? Or am I going to have to sleep in a tent? Or, you know, what would you say to somebody who's listening, kind of curious, have thought about medical missions? Maybe they're on the verge of burnout. And to your point, you just connected the dots. And instead of doing yoga in the morning, maybe there's something else that in which you actually give yourself away to rejuvenate the burnout you're feeling. What would you say to somebody who's kind of on the bubble with exploring some sort of medical missions trip?
I mean, I think there's lots of different avenues to get involved with something like that. A lot of the professional organizations have ways that you can kind of reach out to other people within your specialty to kind of see, you know, what's being done in primary care, what's being done in neurosurgery, you know, obviously for us, peds ortho. So like our peds ortho society of North America has a whole subsection that works on, you know, mission work. And so people can kind of get connected. You know, we have some things when there are hurricanes, earthquakes in other countries that we can kind of pull together teams of surgeons to be involved that are interested in doing things like that. So I think from a just simply getting involved standpoint, probably it's either sort of knowing people that are already doing it, or it's getting involved through your professional organization. And there's lots of opportunities that are out there, and each of them are probably a little bit different. when we go down, we actually stay in a decent hotel. So I'm not sleeping in a tent. I get a nice warm shower every day. I'm getting three meals every day. I'm not drinking the water, but, you know, bottled water otherwise. But, you know, for the most part, it's a trip that we can kind of focus on the surgical side. But there are trips that people may have less accommodations. And so I think as you're looking, you just have to find out what's going to fit you. I had a conversation with one of my residents about that recently where they were kind of interested in going somewhere. And I said, no offense, you know, the accommodations for where you're staying, it's not what you're used to. Is this something you really want to do? And so kind of working through that side of things too. But I think just finding other like-minded individuals that are sort of already involved is the easiest way to sort of get involved initially. And then if it's a passion, many people have turned those sort of first few trips into passions of like, this is what I'm going to be really dedicated with. And some of my colleagues that go to, on Project Perfect World are much, much more involved with that organization than even I am, you know, of just going on the trips, but they're involved from day one with fundraising and other things like that, where, you know, I did some fundraising for our trip, but not sort of the bigger fundraising that the organization does as a whole. So there's different levels to kind of be involved. I would probably consider myself like at an entry level of doing a couple trips that have been really, really cool and pretty profound to me and hopefully for the patients down there too.
Are you planning to go back this fall?
Yes, I am. I got to make sure my wife's not listening to the podcast. I brought it up actually last night. I said, so I think I'm going to go back to Ecuador in the fall. And she said, I don't have the bandwidth to talk to you about this right now. So that's the other side of it is, you know, it is, it's hard. It's time away from family, which was probably the hardest thing. You know, my kids, I've got two kids and they had a lot going on those few weeks that I was out and I missed some sports stuff that I don't like missing. The financial side of missing work was not as big of a deal to me as the time away from family. So I think that's what she means of she's not ready to discuss it yet. And the other thing too, as you're looking, and this is probably a little bit of her apprehension too, is safety. So, you know, as we go on the mission trips from America to other places, other countries, how safe is it in some of those areas? And Ecuador is a beautiful country, but my second trip was very different. You know, in 18, we got to enjoy the city. We went out for some dinners. We went to some marketplaces and things like that. But for a major city in South America, the safety has become a pretty significant issue. I mean, we had four armed guards with us to and from the hotel to the hospital and back and forth every day. That we had sort of a security team that was hired to work with us just because safety has become a really big issue with, you know, cartel and other issues down in South America. So again, it's a beautiful country. It just, the trip was a little bit different because of some of the safety concerns. So I think that's probably the other piece that my wife is, I didn't share with her all the safety stuff before I went this past time, but we kind of talked about it after and it probably made her not as excited to send me out of the country to go do these sorts of things. But it's such an amazing group that goes, and it's such an amazing hospital and patient population there that, yes, I would like to go again next fall.
Brian, my final question. I know that you've accomplished a lot professionally, both in your practice in the States and accomplished a lot in the lives of the children who you've literally touched in Ecuador. And I know that you didn't get there by yourself. Your profession, your calling is one that relies on others to build into. You mentioned the mentor who kind of inspired you to orthopedics in the first place. And so as we wrap up here, is there somebody that you'd like to just give a shout out to? Somebody who's been really instrumental in maybe the story you're telling now around medical missions or something like that is worthy of a shout out here.
I think from a mission standpoint, the crew that I go with, I mean, they're all peers of mine, but they've been mentors in that area and just seeing their dedication. Matt Schmitz, who's a good friend, Eric Fenore, Jake Schultz, Chris Bray, and Marty Morrison are the crew that we kind of go with. And they're pediatric orthopedic surgeons that are sort of all over the country, San Diego, New York, you know, Greenville, South Carolina. But those are kind of peers. I mean, I mentioned Michael Bossi was the orthopedic trauma doc here in Charlotte that, you know, had a big impact on me early in my career and believed in me enough to kind of push to get me to Carolina's Medical Center for my residency program. The next person was probably my program director at the time. So Steve Frick, who's a pediatric orthopedic surgeon and was a huge influence on sort of my career decisions. You know, as I mentioned at the beginning, You know, we all meet those people that help kind of influence where our interests may lie, whether it's in medicine or whether it's in business. You meet those people that kind of push you towards what they do in their career. So Steve Frick has been one of those people. And then one of the cool things too, I am very fortunate. There's a gentleman by the name of Peter Waters. Dr. Waters was a former chief of surgery at Boston Children's Hospital, and we were pretty lucky. His grandkids live here in the Charlotte area, and so he was done being chief of surgery up there, and he joined us here in Charlotte. Having a senior mentor like that here in practice right now has just been unbelievable. From a leadership standpoint, from a professionalism development standpoint, has just been unbelievable. So, I mean, each of those are kind of people sort of at each step of my journey, you know, and I have no doubt that there will continue to be more people and hopefully can do the same for others as they kind of come through as well. And whether it's mission trip related or, you know, just in orthopedic surgery. So
fantastic. Well, you know, they say we're the average of our five closest friends. And so if that's the case, then you sure are hanging with a good company. And Dr. Brian Scannell, thanks for sharing your story about medical missions. We'll have links to Project Perfect World in the show notes, and appreciate you for our community locally and our community around the world.
Great. Thanks, Shane.
Yep, for sure. And thank you for giving half an hour of your time to listen to the show. If you have suggestions for guests or topics that you'd like to hear on the Prosperous Doc podcast, feel free to email me directly at shane@prosperousdoc.com. As always, we welcome your reviews on Google Play or iTunes, wherever you download your podcasts. And we'll see you back here next time.
This episode of the Prosperous Doc Podcast is over, but you're not alone on your journey. Spa Dameron Tenney has been helping physicians and dentists prosper through financial planning for over 60 years. To connect with us, visit sdtplanning.com today and take your financial wellness to new levels. Join us on the next episode of the Prosperous Doc Podcast.